morning. You've tuned into North Idaho News of the Week here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm here, as usual, with Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing very well. It's a spring day, it seems like, outside.
Spring-ish, I think you would say. But it's rather nice. Yesterday was kind of beautiful, too.
It was. And we're looking at a nice weekend coming up, too. Mm-hmm. It is Friday, February 28th, the last day of February. We're here in the studio also with Zach Hagedon from the Sandpoint Reader, the editor-in-chief of the Sandpoint Reader. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Jack.
Nice to have you here. Yeah. As ever, and here we go with a rundown of the week's news, starting at the state level. I will say that House Bill 158, which we spoke about at greater length last week, that's the Media Shield Law, passed unanimously through the House and looks to face little opposition in the Senate either. The law states, no person engaged in journalistic activities shall be compelled to disclose in any legal proceeding, trial, before any court, or before any jury, the source of any information procured or obtained and published in a newspaper, print publication, digital news outlet, or by radio or television broadcasting station with which the person is engaged or employed or with which the person is connected. Our Sandpoint Reader's Ben Olson submitted some testimony before the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee last week, and we did speak to him about that on this program, and you could read about it in the Reader, too. House Bill 138, which is the Medicaid Expansion Reform or Repeal Bill, which narrowly passed the House, has stalled in the Senate. Its sponsor, Representative Jordan Redman from Coeur d'Alene, has introduced a new bill in the House called titled Medicaid Reform and Cost Containment. That's House Bill 328. It has some changes from the original bill, and he will now try to advance it through the House. Speaking of Redman, he and others were at a town hall event in Coeur d'Alene last week that received some national news coverage when a woman was forcibly removed by plainclothes security at the direction of Kootenai County Sheriff Bob Norris. As the implications of the event unfold, tune in next week when we'll be talking to Kay Thornborough, who's been covering the story for the Coeur d'Alene Press and the Idaho Capital Sun. In our county, here in Bonner County, the Board of Commissioners has unanimously approved a new app for the sheriff. The Idaho Sheriff Connect app has been approved for 1 year. This is apparently not replacing Nixle, which they currently use, but they'll be using it alongside of that to use technology to update themselves and the public about what's going on. The Panhandle Health District has considered informed consent standards for vaccines, or they are considering it. And this a well-attended meeting drew comment from both sides of the aisle. The health district tabled the issue until their March 20th meeting, whether they'll be implementing some sort of informed consent standards or not remains to be seen. The meeting is on March 20th, and the Panhandle, there's more to read about in this week's Reader under Sansary Mitchell's byline about that as well. Here in the city, well, for one thing, we're going to be talking about parking with Zach, I'm sure. I will say also, Baby Moose, the city of Sandpoint, informs us that there are Baby Moose on the loose. Not quite on the loose, but not to approach the baby moose, even if you see them alone. Sometimes the mother will leave the baby moose unattended for a little while. This does not mean the moose is necessarily in distress, and do not approach these wild animals. Also, that's an important message from the city of Sandpoint. Also, the local parking lot plan, that's the downtown city parking lot plan, kind of redevelopment has passed city council. It was actually tied in city council 3-3. Mayor Grimm cast the tie-breaking vote, and so it goes now to the Urban Forestry Commission. And if unless they have strong objections, the city parking lot will be redeveloped, and that redevelopment will take place, according to the city's timetable, will take place this spring, in time for Lost in the 50s. Other parking developments in the city are still contentious, and there's been a flurry of op-eds flying back and forth in the papers the last few weeks. We discussed parking, I feel like it was within the last month, we kind of talked about potential parking developments, but the matter is still probably a top of mind for most of, as far as city politics goes, for most of the residents. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. What's changed since last time we talked, if anything, and what have we learned? That's my news. And before we dive into parking discussion, did I miss anything big?
Well, we are going to have a little clip on proposal.
Yeah.
To do a bunch of conservation work and public access for the Sand Creek corridor that's being worked on by the city of Sandpoint, for one, but also the Kinnickskill Land Trust and other partners. And there was an open house on that on Monday, and Jack, you and I both happened to be there at the same time and asked a few questions that we're going to air towards the end of this broadcast.
That is right. Yeah, we talked to Katie Cox and Reagan Plum from the Kinnickskill Land Trust about that. Well, Zach, is parking the first thing to dive into? Anything else I mentioned? Let me ask you, do you know anything more about this Idaho Sheriff Connect app? It doesn't replace Nixle. Is this going to affect your work at all, as far as you know? Or is this not something you, is this more just sheriff's business and not something that affects their relationship with the outside world as much?
Well, I think it's going to provide, you know, a lot of more in-depth detail on stuff that's going on. I mean, I feel like most people are probably hooked into Nixle already. I mean, I know I get constant updates on my phone.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think as the sheriff sort of pointed out at that commissioner's meeting, you know, Nixle's fine and all, but it isn't quite as sort of robust and real time in terms of the detail that they would like to be able to push out. They also use Facebook a lot at the sheriff's office. But, you know, that requires like a staff member to sit down and, you know, type up a Facebook post and then send it out and then moderate it and all this other stuff. So the Sheriff Connect app is, I think, a broader sort of dashboard of information you can get. And it's operated on like a third party platform. It doesn't require a lot of, you know, labor on the part of the sheriff's office. I mean, they have to input the information, but.
Yeah.
So I guess from a newspaper standpoint, it's going to be good. I mean, it's always good to have more information and quicker information. So I think that it wasn't the big concern at the commissioner meetings leading up to the approval of it was privacy. There were a lot of questions at a meeting earlier in February, I think it was, about like who controls this data, you know, like user data, like people who sign up for this, like because it's a third party application, is the third party selling like email addresses, phone numbers, whatever, names to other data brokers? And you know, I think the sheriff addressed all that it's secure, and you know, nobody's selling anybody's information. So if you sign up for it, you know, you don't have to worry, according to him, that your info is going to get sold off and you're suddenly going to start getting pop-up ads for you know, whatever.
Legitimate question to be asked.
Right.
For sure.
It was a robust discussion, and I think that the sheriff took it to heart. So when he returned with that other presentation, he directly talked about that at length.
Let's talk about parking. What changes are coming to Sandpoint parking in general, starting, I guess, with the city lot, the downtown city lot?
That's the big one.
Yep. And that's what there's been major movement on this past week.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of backstory on it, and not to belabor that, but we've been talking about redoing this parking lot since at least 2014, when Mayor Grimm, you know, before he was mayor, was on the Sandpoint Urban Renewal Agency board, and at that time sort of made the motion at SURA to fund this, and it's been funded on an ongoing basis ever since. So it's not like it's a new idea. you know, I didn't put this in the piece because it was not super relevant. I mean, we all know that the parking lot's in bad shape, but it hasn't actually been resurfaced since 1980 or 81. Okay. So that explains the condition it's in. Mm-hmm. So obviously an ongoing long-term priority, but hasn't really had any traction, so to speak, over those years. Although now we've managed to get a preliminary design put together, which, you know, there's an image of it in the paper and it's on the city's website as well. And that was before the council at their last meeting, or two meetings ago, on February 19th. And they got a big presentation, you know, from Holly Ellis, from Eric Bush, from Brandon Stagland, all city staff members in sort of the public works and urban forestry and engineering divisions, sort of walking council through, you know, what the changes were going to be. And they were being asked, the council was being asked to approve that preliminary design, move it on to a final design phase, and then put it out to bid with the idea, as you mentioned, Jack, of getting construction started, you know, get it out to bid in March, get that bid accepted in March, and then have construction occur about 3 weeks, over the course of 3 weeks, mm-hmm. in April and into May, to have it completely done in time for Lost in the 50s, not because of that event in particular, but because that traditionally sort of marks the beginning of the busy season, mm-hmm. when that parking lot gets a lot of heavy use. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the generalities. They voted on a tie, you know, to move this thing forward, and I'll get into why that was a little bit later. But you know, Jeremy Grimm, the mayor, he broke that tie and made it very clear even prior to the vote that he was going to vote in favor of it. I mean, obviously he's the one who proposed it to Sura in 2014, so mm-hmm. we knew all along what his thoughts were on this. But the specific changes that are envisioned in this preliminary plan, which is now moving into a final phase, so this is all still changeable, you know, to a certain degree, but this is the baseline plan that they've now moved forward, is that they're going to remove the north and south entrance and exits that we have currently.
Those are on Church Street and yep. Oak Street.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they're going to replace those, so block them off entirely, and then make one entrance and exit on 3rd Avenue. And that will be just like in and out, like one, you know, two lanes. And the idea there was to keep the traffic from sort of pouring off and on to Church and Oak, where especially Oak on the north side has a lot of stuff going on, as Mayor Grimm pointed out in the meeting. You know, we've got people who exit and enter that parking lot are crossing, you know, a sidewalk, at least one bike lane. They're coming into and out of a pretty busy street mm-hmm. on Oak with free-flowing traffic. If you're making a left, you're immediately running into a controlled stop on 3rd. Mm-hmm. So traffic can back up at that stoplight. So you, when you could get sort of jammed up. You got people crossing the street on foot, you know, from like the Taekwondo studio. Mm-hmm. There's the other parking lot sort of behind what I guess used to be Sotheby's. They've moved, but that big lot right there, people are moving in and out of that. You got bank traffic. It's just, as the mayor said, you know, there's just too much going on, and it's like a disaster waiting to happen. So,
especially with big vehicles parked along
right.
Oak Street, makes it difficult to see out.
Yeah. I mean, with our current, you know, obsession with enormous trucks, as a regular user of the city lot, I don't drive an enormous truck, but when I'm trying to make a turn out of that, and if there's two giant trucks parked on either side of the entrance exit, I can't see anything mm-hmm. that's going on Oak. So I have to inch out in sort of like, it's not a leap of faith, it's like a crawl of faith, so I don't get sideswiped, which isn't...
You know, you stick your nose out there
yeah.
so other people can that are driving on Oak can see you coming.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know that necessarily having that single entrance on 3rd is going to change that dynamic. I mean, you could still have that occur on 3rd, but at least you're limiting the amount of cars that are moving in and out, you know, from different directions. Mm-hmm. So that was a major discussion point at the meeting. Councilors Kyle Schreiber and Rick Howarth were especially concerned about that single entrance, concerns about, you know, congestion right there. At some point, we're going to have paid parking in that lot. So on the rendering, there's a couple of sort of cross-hatched areas right next on either side of the entrance, the new entrance on 3rd, inside the lot, which eventually will be where the kiosks go for whatever kind of paid parking technology we end up using. So Councilor Schreiber had a pretty good point. He's like, well, I mean, imagine a scenario, which is not too hard to imagine, where someone is trying to pay and they're fumbling around in their car with their credit card. You know, maybe they drop their card, you know, mm-hmm. they can't figure out how to use the technology. You know, kids are yelling in the back of the car. Like any number of things could happen to delay you at that at that kiosk. Then you're backing up traffic on Third. You're backing up traffic inside the lot.
But they do have pay systems where you go and park, and then you pay.
And that was sort of the rejoinder to that was like, well, we don't know what kind of technology we're going to use. It could be sort of like cardless. You know, I mean, it's probably not going to be an arm, you know, that blocks you there. So there's ways around that issue. Councillor Howarth's concern was, you know, you're again congestion, but also when you make that only one entrance point, if you can't find a space, you're circling and circling and circling. With the two entrances and exits, you know, you could sort of pick your poison, and then you could sort of zip in, zip out if you didn't see something. And with this design, you know, once you're in the lot, you're in the lot. Like, you're kind of stuck. And the again, sort of the rejoinder to that was this parking technology could be deployed that shows you exactly where the open spots are when you get in. So you can kind of beeline for that instead of hunting, you know, as we do now. So, I mean,
so if it did they have discussion if it proves problematic with a single entrance that they might open one of the old
it entrances? Is possible. I mean, it's not an, it wouldn't be a super impossible thing to do to reopen one of those. And I think that if they did reopen one, my gut tells me that they would reopen the Church Street one. And you know, Joel, Councilor Spiro, who owns Joel's across the street, very popular restaurant, accounts for a lot of the sort of in and out traffic right there. I mean, he was kind of okay with retaining those entrances. Although he did note, you know, there's a ton of foot traffic back and forth across the parking lot to his restaurant. But it's not quite as bad as on Oak, I guess. So there is a potential someday, if it doesn't work out, that that could be reopened. The other major bone of contention was the trees. And it was interesting, you know, watching the meeting, you could kind of feel the tension rise when someone mentioned removing trees, because we have kind of a fraught history in town with city projects removing trees. And this envisions, you know, basically removing all the trees that are currently there.
Not the trees that are along the actual street, so.
No, we're not talking about street trees. The trees within the parking lot itself. Because, you know, according to the city forester and the city engineer, you know, a lot of those trees are dead, they say, and need to come out anyway. But also, you know, they need to make way for more spaces, bigger spaces. So the moment that came up, you could tell there was kind of a rise in the temperature. Like, okay, are we going to have people freaking out about, you know, cutting down these mature shade trees? The only piece of public testimony came from Paige Belfry, who's a certified arborist and a member of the city's tree commission. And she strenuously argued against approving the plan that night because no one had consulted an arborist or the tree commission. And she was very adamant, like, you can save most of these trees if you design around them, and we should retain them because they have real economic value. They have real aesthetic value, environmental value. I mean, there's been loads of studies that really can like quantify the value of mature trees. I mean, it's not just like a, you know, sort of hippie environmental tree hugger thing. Like, these are actual economic assets. And so she really, really wanted that to be taken into account. I think everyone agreed ultimately that that should be taken into account. So that's why it's going to the Urban Forest Commission next for that, that body's sort of analysis, recommendations, whatever. So as it stands, you know, you look at the map or the rendering, and there isn't a lot of tree cover in that design. I mean, we've basically got that little copse of trees on the, what is that, southeast side. There's trees on the corners of the parking blocks, I guess, and then two trees sort of in the middle. And, you know, lots of these, well, I mean, most if not all of these would be newly planted trees. And the argument also was made, you know, it's like you plant new trees into an urban environment, they almost always die. So you have to replace them, and then you never actually get to the point where they become mature. So you might say you're replacing mature trees, but you're really not. Was the argument. And Councillor Duquette was pretty adamant about that as well, which explains why there was a tie. So Schreiber, Howarth, and Duquette voted against moving the plan forward, you know, citing those things we just talked about, right? The idea of the single entrance and then the removal of the trees. It's not that they didn't want to see the parking lot redone. It was just they felt like it was too quick. There was a lot of haste where haste was not needed. And they figured we should probably talk about this a lot more and get a much more solid design that, you know, sort of addresses a lot of those concerns. the other three counselors, you know, Counselor Justin Dick, Deb Rule, who was the acting president that night, and Counselor Respiro, they all voted in favor. So that's why Mayor Grimm had to break the tie.
Mm-hmm. But it will go to the Urban Forestry Commission, and they'll get to have a say on it.
They'll have a say, and then yeah. It's going to go to the downtown business owners. They're going to get, you know, sort of a presentation on this through various city outreach efforts. Mm-hmm. And then it has to go to Sura, because, of course, Sura is going to pay for it.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask next, is how's this funded? Who's going to pay for this?
Well, according to the presentation they gave on the 19th, there's $150,000 in the fiscal 2025 budget.
Mm-hmm.
But the total cost estimate of the project is $400,000.
Yeah.
Which is a substantial difference. So there's going to have to be some discussion at Sura, I guess, about how to pull all that money together.
Yeah.
There was talk of the city itself doing the demolition work to kind of cut down on costs, use city staff to actually rip out the existing asphalt and pavement and all that. So I guess the funding piece is still, I mean, it's been identified.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard if it's been solidified.
Okay.
And that's going to be a process in itself.
Okay, a couple more questions before we move on. Right. By my count here, it doesn't look like it only adds about 7 spots to the existing lot.
It's not like we're going to see a huge dramatic increase in the number of spaces. Mm-hmm. But what's happening here is, you know, we're sort of formalizing the lot in a way so that the spaces that we have currently are way too small. Mm. They were striped at a time before we had a certain code that dictates the...
Are there stripes?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the wintertime, who knows? Right. I use that lot all the time. And even today when I pulled into it, I was like, am I in the stall? I have to open the door and look out to see.
It is in pretty bad shape.
The existing spaces are too narrow and they're not long enough. Mm-hmm. So there's an attempt on this plan to, you know, bring all those other spots up to code, make them bigger. And we all, I mean, as I was alluding to earlier, like everybody drives these 8,000 pound trucks now. So it's, I mean, back in the day, you know, even a pickup truck was probably like a third of the size of some of the ones that drive around town now. Mm-hmm. So all the spots in the middle portion of the lot are going to be bigger and longer to accommodate sort of those bigger vehicles. The southeast corner, as it's envisioned currently, will be sort of compact cars, so similar in size to the ones we have today. And then they're adding a bunch more sort of handicap spots, ADA spots, and leaving room for future infrastructure like the paid parking stuff. And then hopefully, eventually, electric vehicle charging is envisioned. Mm-hmm. So they're doing a lot more with that space. And because they're doing a lot more with it in various parts of it, sort of adds up to more spaces, but not maybe as many more as, you know, people might have thought if we just like redid the whole thing in the same sort of lane or stall size that we have today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A plan that I've heard floated out there before is the idea of eventually making this a multi-level parking situation.
Well, yeah.
Are they incorporating any, you know, openings for that at all? Or does that come into this, or when that happened, if that should happen, is that something that, again, is just going to be demolish and start again?
Well, longtime attentive readers of the Reader will know that for the past probably 5 years, more than 5 since I've been back at the editor's desk, I have predicted in our end of year edition that there will be talk of a parking garage.
Mm-hmm.
And every year I am wrong.
There's no action,
I guess, is what I would say. But I mean, I think it was a year or two ago, there was some pretty serious discussion about getting a proposal together to approach a multi-level parking structure there.
Mm-hmm.
Urban Renewal actually took that item up. There was, you know, sort of a timeline that was roughly sketched for, you know, getting that moved over to a different ownership and then sold eventually to a developer. So there is a sort of a plan, a rough plan, of converting this from city property to like Sura property, if I'm correct, and then Sura sort of being the broker to a private developer at some point. And that is probably very far in the future. I mean, from what I've heard, I think I actually heard someone say at one point 5 to 10, maybe 15 years is realistic.
In millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars. Yeah. These are very, very expensive pieces of infrastructure.
Yeah.
And the ability to pay for that is going to be multi-sourced, of course. I mean, you can imagine that the city would probably have some stake in that. Mm-hmm. Maybe Sura. You know, a private developer probably have to bring some money to that. And I think that part of the push, I think, for the general paid parking program that we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks is to create revenue streams that can go toward that kind of development in the future. I mean, we talk about maintenance and, you know, building infrastructure, but I think we also long-term, it's creating a pool of money that can be put towards something like that.
Yeah.
And it's in terms of like doing all this work here at the city lot and then someday building a structure on there, I don't think that it would be too much of a heavy lift just to rip all that out and then build on top of it.
Yeah.
But we definitely would lose all the trees then.
Well, right. Yeah. Then there you go. Okay. Well, in our remaining moments, can you kind of summarize the discussion of the parking at City Beach, which I think, you know, just in my own personal experience, that seems like the topic that that is fresh on people's minds, at least.
Right.
plenty of other things to think about, of course, going on. But as far as city business, that seems like the thing that people are talking about right now.
Right. And, you know,
I have two here. I have two issues of the reader here, one last week and one this week, and both of them have an op-ed, one from the Bonner County Republican Women, one from Jason Welker, or a perspective column, right. I guess you would say. Yeah. And so there seems to be these things are going back and forth a little bit.
There's a lot more sound and fury around this topic than there is, you know, activity, I guess. What we're in right now is sort of a battle of perspective on what city code requires of a developer, such as, you know, Avril Hospitality in particular, in this case, looking to build that resort hotel where the current Best Western Edgewater is. So the Bonner County Republican Women, this is the second op-ed they've written on this topic, and their central argument is that Avril, as the developer at that site, was required by city code to have a certain number of parking spaces. And if they didn't want to meet that required number, there's an option in city code to pay an in-lieu fee, which is a certain amount of money. I think it's $10,000 per space that you don't build. So by their reckoning in the code, that meant that Avril, if they had built all the spaces they required, was probably on the hook for close to $1 million. By building the number of, or proposing the number of spaces that they have proposed and paying the in-lieu fee, should have been $400,000. And then, you know, she argues that the sort of they argue that the city kind of improperly let Avril off the hook. But, you know, the planning and community development director, Jason Welker, has written two articles now as well on this topic, pushing back against that interpretation, saying that, you know, there are multiple items in that city parking code. There are, you know, three options. The first one is you calculate the number of spaces using a table in city code with the minimum and maximum surface parking requirement, and then that's what you build. The second part of that is to pay a parking in lieu fee of $10,000 a space. And then the third option is you conduct a site-specific demand analysis to figure out the actual demands. Avril used number two and number three. And that means that, you know, they built the number of spaces that they felt like they needed to build or are going to build, and they paid the in-lieu fee at the same time. So he argues that's kind of a win-win for the city. And there was nothing inappropriate about it. There was no kickback. There was no sort of sweetheart deal. And I guess that's where it sits. I mean, the as far as I've heard, we haven't seen any, you know, building permits pulled for this project. So what we're really talking about here is theoretical parking spaces. And it's kind of a theoretical argument, which is why you haven't seen a lot of reporting on it, because it's really just an argument at this point.
Yeah.
And we'll have to wait to see, you know, what transpires when some of this stuff starts getting actually like solidified at the city and we start seeing real like work happen at the site. Yeah. I mean the Best Western Edgewater is still there. So I mean, that's how far away we are from actually seeing this come to fruition. And meanwhile, you know, like I say, it's just an argument at this point, and people can make of it what they will.
Is the idea of paying for parking at City Beach or paying for a parking permit at City Beach, that's still, is that on the agenda somewhere, or where is that in the
That hasn't process? Gone away at all. I mean, the last time we reported on it was when they brought a revised draft plan.
That was just a week or so ago.
So they had a meeting, I think it was in January, I could be wrong there, but it was a while back where they first presented the idea. There was a lot of people showed up. There was more testimony at that. It was like a planning and zoning commission meeting.
Planning and zoning.
Which, you know, never gets an audience. But there was a lot of people there voicing a lot of concerns. Welker was there taking notes. And then they returned for another meeting where they addressed all those concerns. And, you know, the city actually did take a lot of that stuff into account that people were saying. And redid parts of the proposal to address that stuff. Like, for instance, they raised the fee, which, you know, kind of paradoxically, people wanted to see a higher fee, which is not what you would expect. But they did, because they wanted to further discourage out-of-town users at City Beach. So they argued that the residents were happy to pay more to discourage out-of-towners.
Yeah, instead of $10, $15, I think. That was one number that I saw used.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I felt like they doubled it. So they went from 10 to 20 for in-town, and then from 20 to 40.
Double what the in-town people would pay.
So that was part of the new plan. The other part of it was that they added a fee for boat launching, which is something that the community didn't necessarily ask for, but that the state of Idaho, the Department of Recreation, they really encourage cities to pay for boat launch because then it pays for their own boat launch facilities instead of cities coming to the state being like, give us money from a grant to rebuild our boat launch. It's like, no, pay people to or charge people to use your boat launch and then pay for it yourself. So that was part of it. Then they increased the amount of time you can park under your permit. So if you're an in-town user, you pay your $20. You get 4 hours of parking at City Beach instead of two, which was the previous version. And then after that, you pay sort of the day rate or hour rate or whatever it is.
Yeah. This is all still planning and zoning we're talking about. This hasn't gone to City Council yet?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Yeah, I mean, I feel like every meeting I've gone to has been at P&Z because this is still very much a proposal.
Right.
And they're at they're just at the highest, broadest policymaking level of this.
Yeah.
And I think it was mentioned in that first article back in, I think it was January, where we shouldn't expect to see any of this till 2026.
Yeah.
So we have a long way to go. And we haven't even figured out what kind of technology we're going to use, you know, any of that stuff. This is just figuring out how we might do it and what the system would look like.
Yeah. I will mention for those of you who haven't been listening to every single week's program that the reason that it's that the permit is double, or the reason it's not free in the city and then charge $200 for out-of-towners or something, is that the federal government prohibits that because some of the land in the parking lot was paid for by a federal grant.
Land, water, conservation grant, And it has a formula.
You can only charge double. One group can only pay twice as much.
Not more than twice as much.
Not more.
That's the limitation there. A lot of people aren't getting because they're urging that residents be free, but in what's such case, you wouldn't be able to charge the out-of-towners.
And the thing that's still making people angry, which, you know, I don't think is going to change, I don't think the city's going to budge on this, is county residents argued pretty vociferously at the meeting that they should be counted as locals and pay the $20. But the city's like, you don't live in the city. So I'm sorry. I mean, you might use the beach all the time, but you don't pay the city taxes to maintain it. So that's kind of riled some people up. And
city residents do pay
a
good chunk more in taxes than county residents.
Well, this will be further discussion. This is still, I was going to ask if the county has any moves to make there, if the county could contribute in some way, if, you know, the county government could contribute in some way to City Beach to, you know, to make that a possibility, but we'll see. Because it's still at planning and zoning right now, and like you said, this is still a long ways out. Discussions ongoing. Nice long North Idaho News of the Week this week.
Right.
Because there's a little bit more to come.
Yeah, right? we have another interview here. Chris, it was Monday night that we ran into each other over there at the James E. Russell Sports Center.
Yeah, and the new community room. Turned out that's a handy spot to have a community meeting, such as the one that was held by Kinnexy Land Trust and some partners to look at the plans for the Sand Creek Corridor.
I'm gonna play this recording, and that'll end our program for the day, and then we'll continue with Otto's Eclectic Mix. Zach, thank you so much for being here. Did we miss any important things that you want to mention in this week's reader or coming up next week or anything like that?
Oh, there's so much more we could talk about.
I know.
I don't want to drag it out, but there's lots of good stuff coming. I'll just say that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks very much for your time, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And here we go. The next voice you hear, I think, will be mine, but will be recorded on Monday, talking to Katie Cox and Reagan Plum from the Kinnickzu Land Trust. Okay, we are recording. I'm Jack Peterson, here with Chris Bessler, and I'm also here with Katie Cox, the Executive Director.
And Reagan Plum.
Reagan Plum, yes, the Conservation Director, both of the Kinnickzu Land Trust. Well, Katie, why don't you tell us where we are? Set the stage here.
Okay.
Where are we right now?
We are right now in the James E. Russell Athletic Center Community Room at Traverse Park. We're conducting a open house today, Monday, from 3 to 6. We asked our community to come in and give us their feedback on what we have created so far in terms of a vision for the Sand Creek Corridor, specifically focusing on the area from Popsicle Bridge to Schweitzer Cutoff Road. And this is a culmination of about 2.5 years of community listening and work that has created the plan that our community members are walking around and looking at right now.
Mm-hmm. So there are like 5 kind of overarching goals, and with each of those goals under that, there is a whole set of sub-goals, right?
That's right,
So, Reagan, can you rattle those off, the 5 big goals?
Oh, let's see. There's actually 6, Chris.
6, okay.
I know there's 6.
Right.
Let's see.
I didn't count it right. Okay.
Yeah, so we've got access and recreation. We have stewardship and maintenance. We have education, community, and culture. We have water quality. We have wildlife habitat. And we have land protection. How about that?
Yeah.
Woohoo! High five! Yeah, and
those are
groupings that we designated based on the types of feedback and suggestions we got from the community. So we've received hundreds of ideas from community members about what they would like to see for this corridor, and we did the best we could to kind of collate those into these general thematic categories, which I've just listed for you.
So on the conservation side, what kind of shape is that section of land along the creek and in the creek itself? Is it in good shape or is it polluted?
It's in pretty, there are some water quality issues there, but in general, it's in pretty spectacular condition. And that really is the inspiration for this work, because we realized that this is a gem in our community, and it's amazingly ecologically rich and special. And if we don't do some concerted planning around it, it could easily be lost in the future. So that's exactly why we're here today.
So part of it is to restore and maintain the health of the plants, animals within this corridor.
We're really trying to tease out what the community wants to see for that corridor, but that's our hope, that there will be some restoration and mitigation efforts that come from that to protect it and make it even better.
So kind of the exciting thing is the access, recreation, and amenities, because there's a set of goals underneath that. And Katie, we were just talking before we went on the recording here about the fact that you can actually canoe right now, mm-hmm. as far as the Schweitzer Cutoff.
Yeah, it's very easy to put your canoe in down at City Beach or at at the park just opposite of the bridge, Bridge Street, and canoe all the way up this corridor, all the way to Schweitzer Cutoff Road. It's very simple to do, and it is one of the most enjoyable things to do on a summer day in Sandpoint.
And probably very few people really know about that.
Have
you done it a couple times?
I've done it a couple
into
times.
Other people doing it on those days?
We have. We spent a lot of time as part of this project. We actually spent a number of days on the creek ourselves, taking different people up there. This is a project in that has been supported through a technical assistance grant through the National Park Service. It's called the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Grant. So we took our Brianna, who's been helping us with the plan up there. And when you go up there, you usually see one or two people. We often see somebody in their kayak fishing. or somebody on paddle boards. It's not well known, but it is enjoyed by a few people. So, yeah, it's pretty special.
I noticed that one of the goals in the access recreation amenities was having a rope swing. Which harkens back to the days when we had a rope swing on Sand Creek before the bypass came in.
That is where this is, I think that's what's breathing life into this suggestion, which we heard from obviously things that are appearing on these sheets as goals or objectives or actions are things that we have heard from community members. And so many people remember the days of the rope swing and wanted to see it brought back. So it does, it's sitting here. It is, I will say, there's a bit of controversy about should we have a rope swing, should we not have a rope swing, liability about a rope swing. But it's living here right now on the plan. Yeah.
Okay. Who else is involved? You got the Kinnixu Land Trust. You guys are, would we say, leading the charge on this?
We've had a core group of six different partners that have been involved since the beginning. Okay. Kinnixu Land Trust, the Kalispell Tribe, the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society, the Trust for Public Land, and the cities of Sandpoint and Ponderay.
Okay.
And then we have a bunch of additional sort of accessory partners who have along the way been brought in to review the plan at certain points. Those include other state agencies, local county group, the other nonprofit partners or organizations that are, you know, have important work or just their areas of expertise touch this project. So, and that sort of larger subgroup is probably about 30 different individuals.
Also adjacent landowners represented there, and we've really tried to prioritize the voices of the people that actually live right there on Sand Creek. We really want to honor and respect their vision and their wishes for the future of the Creek Corridor.
So starting about 2.5 years ago, that's when this germ of an idea, I guess, hit the blank page. And where are we now, and how far along are we? What comes next?
We are very close to the finish, which is very nice. This is the last point for community comment, and now what we're going to do is we're going to take what we've learned here today. We've asked our community members to put a dot on the five areas that are most important to them. That helps us to understand the priorities of our community. We've also asked our community to make notes of anything that they see here in this vision that's on the wall that they have a challenge with, or something that they think we may have missed, or something that they want clarification on. So really we're trying to gather all those voices, get all the last public input before we take this plan, put it together into a final plan, and then our hope is that we then hand this over to the cities of Ponderay and the city of Sandpoint, and they then fold it into their planning. So what we've done here for the cities is really gather all those community voices so that when they have issues or zoning, they're thinking about zoning or thinking about priorities in terms of comprehensive planning, that they'll refer to this document. This document gives them an indication of the voices of their community members and what they want to see in the area. In addition to that, we will, as a this collective group, work to figure out how to make sure we start implementing parts of this plan going forward.
Well, I think we're about out of time for this little segment we have here, but if people want to see the plan, or is there an opportunity to comment beyond this open house?
I would say for the next few days, if people wanted to reach out and comment, we can definitely share a copy of the plan. But now moving forward, we're going to be starting to finalize it and put the polishing touches on it, and at a point we'll have to cut off that feedback or opportunity. Yeah.
So if they want the plan, they can write to info@kinnixu.org. That's kanikSU.org. And we'll send it to them.
Well, okay. We said 5 minutes. It's been 9. So you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for coming
today.
Miss
anything?
It's great to see you both.
No. Yeah. Thanks for coming.